That was the weirdest experience. Two grown men messing with my ears.
We keep messing with it. I'm sorry. I said I was a fan, but, well, I don't know if that's going to stay or not.
Well, we'll try. All right, well, the point of this second message to you is to encourage you in your evangelism, in your witness in the world, wherever you go, actually, that I believe this modern world needs a full-orbed presentation of the Christian gospel, not a simplistic one that really doesn't get to the heart of who we are as human beings, and thus really doesn't address so many of the questions. That we need to have a robust, and I know you folks get this, so in a certain sense I'm talking to the choir, and that was an excellent choir, by the way. Thank you so much. That we need a robust witness to the biblical truth, because we are now facing a robust presentation of paganism, which is seeking to apply this individual enlightenment experience to the whole of existence. And this is why I think it's very interesting to see that Paul now exhorts Christians to have a transformed mind, able to discern the will of God. And as I suggested to you, what Paul was talking about in his day was truly mind-blowing. That here, Paul was exhorting Christians to think in a totally different way than the people around him in the pagan world. And because he goes on, does he not, to indicate that there are two kinds of minds. There's this discerning mind, which has been transformed. But then there is the undiscerning mind, which he mentions actually in the first chapter in Romans 1:28, where he talks about the undiscerning mind. And clearly for the Apostle Paul, there are no neutral facts. We all look at the same world. Those with discernment see the truth, and those without discernment believe the lie. And so our world more and more needs clear thinking. More and more we're given over, it seems to me, to a false view of thinking. Our young people are subjected to this day and night, through the media of all kinds, based on, as I indicated, this principle of oneness. And Paul says, he said to the Christians back then, and it surely implies applies even more to us, that we need not conformity to this world, but, I'm making up a word, transformity. The knowledge of the Holy One is understanding. What does Paul mean by this transformed mind? The only other time he uses the verb transform is in 2 Corinthians 3:18, where he writes, "We all with unveiled faces," recalling the experience of Moses on Mount Sinai, "behold the glory of the Lord and are being transformed." This is a reference to that event on the Mount of Transfiguration when Jesus was transformed. That's the same verb, by the way, or transfigured before them, and his face shone like the sun. And Paul, I believe, is indicating for these Roman Christians a radical intellectual transformation. Obviously, it goes deeper than the mind, but he is talking about the mind. And in today's world, where the mind is actually pushed away, and certainly so in pagan mystical thinking, it's interesting to see how Paul put such an emphasis upon the mind. He says he doesn't say it. It's Peter who says it in 2 Peter 1:16 through 18. For we did not follow cleverly devised myths, but we were eyewitnesses of his majesty. This is the same event Peter is now talking about, where Jesus is transformed. And this is how Peter describes it. For when he received honor and glory from God the Father, and the voice was borne to him by the majestic glory, this is my beloved Son with whom I'm well pleased. We ourselves heard this very voice, born from heaven, for we were with him on the mount. Peter says we didn't follow cleverly devised myths. It's interesting to see how our world is turning to myths to solve our problems. They're actually turning away from reason, even that bad version of reason, secular humanism. Secular humanism is on the run. And we now live in what's called the post-secular age. Now, hear me right, I did not say post-Christian, I did not say post-modern, I said post-secular. In other words, there's a whole movement afoot now to seek to attract the intelligent mind and add to it the old myths of spirituality so that we can function on all four cylinders, so they say. The secular humanist needs to add this extra gear of spirituality that this new paganism will bring to the world. And so we really are in the midst of a revival of pagan thinking. But the Christian may not use myths, but the account of an historical event from eyewitnesses in order to meet the truth about Jesus. One particular form of this myth is the Jungian transpersonal psychology. And in that book that Francis showed you, I have a whole chapter on the influence of Carl Jung on today's world in his description of transpersonal psychology through the means of ancient pagan myths and the fantasies that those myths allow human beings now to deploy. And that's where many people are finding good sense and healthy minds, is by unleashing their fantasies. Hence the success of 50 Shades of Grey, I imagine. But the Holy Spirit wants to transform us both spiritually and rationally, not via mysticism or via irrationality, but by truth about a historical event. And the truth is that ultimate reality is not matter that creates itself and then miraculously creates thinking human beings to think about it, as paganism so foolishly claims. The ultimate reality is the personal creator who made matter, from whom comes an intelligent personal word from outside of nature and calls it into existence ex nihilo. The context of this little debate that I see going on in Paul between the discerning mind and the undiscerning mind is that of Romans 1:28, which is, of course, that whole section which begins the epistle, where Paul talks about sinful human knowing, where people unrighteously suppress the truth, verse 18. They do not honor God as God, but become foolish in their thinking. And the foolishness, actually, that Paul is implying is that people begin to worship nature. The other God is not nothing, it's actually nature, and thus, finally, themselves. This is a rejection of the notion throughout the Bible of the true other God as totally other. But rejecting this God has fearful results. In Romans 1:28, here's what Paul says: God gives them up to an undiscerning mind. So people are involved in this, in refusing the truth, and their minds become undiscerning. And that undiscerning mind has implications, has implications for theology, spirituality, and sexuality, according to the first chapter of Romans. But the renewed mind sees true, healthy difference between the Creator and the creature. Theologians call this the antithesis between truth and falsehood, and really the antithesis between God and the world, but a good one. The fallen mind has always wanted synthesis, wholeness. As human beings try to take what is distinct and join them together. And so this is why I have tried to understand what Paul says in Romans 1:25, I think as the key verse of my thinking, and I think the key verse of that first chapter, where he describes two ways of functioning, two ways of thinking. Romans 1:25 says, they exchanged the truth of God for the lie and worshiped and served the creation rather than the creature. I've read that many times, but I guess at some point, not too far in the past, it suddenly hit me that Paul was making an absolutely outrageous, incredible statement, that there are actually only two ways of being a human being. You either worship creation or you worship the Creator. And that's it. That's a very interesting observation, really, because the British theologian Colin Gunton, without citing the Apostle Paul, says there are really only two questions that we can ask about reality. Does reality create itself, or is it created by an intelligent personal being? Those are the two options before which we stand, always, ever. But Paul said it first and said it that way. So the transformed mind separates God, sees that God is separate from the creation, and will maintain that. You know, when people tell you, I have this religion, and if you do what I say, you can become God, don't believe them. Because the problem with that is, to become God, you have to have always existed, and you have to be the creator of everything else. So there's no way of sort of going back to become God. You either are or you're not. And clearly, we have to give God the respect due to him as the only creator. So the true mind understands who God is as separate from the creation. The undiscerning mind worships and serves the creation as God. Today's version of oneism is mouthed by global politicians, United Nations documents, Hollywood spiritualists, and religious leaders. And they have no place for the God of creation. Thus, we are faced with an enormous challenge to maintain a transformed mind in a world that is more and more buying this undiscerning way of thinking. And the choice, as I'm indicating, I'd like to put it in different terminology just to get your attention. We either embrace, and I'll use these phrases, a homo cosmology whose essential nature is union and synthesis. Remember, homo means same. Or we embrace a hetero cosmology whose key is difference. Hetero means different. So we either embrace a homo cosmology that draws everything together. Think of a circle and everything is in the circle. Man, rocks, trees, animals, and God, all the same. Or we embrace a hetero cosmology and maintain that God is distinct from us. So we embrace then a homo theology, where God and us are the same, and everything is the same. Or we embrace a hetero theology, where God is different than us. We either embrace a homo spirituality, which ends up worshiping ourselves, or a hetero spirituality, worshiping and serving the Creator. And it's interesting that Paul actually goes to this point. We either embrace homosexuality, which embraces this kind of spirituality, or a heterosexuality, which embodies the notion of difference and distinction. So these elements, the spirituality, the sexuality, the theology that is the product of the undiscerning mind, all hold together in a very rational structure, as a matter of fact. And that's why we cannot simply treat what we see today, what's going on in terms of gender, as merely an issue of civil rights. It is a deeply spiritual, religious issue that is being foisted upon our fellow friends and neighbors that will really bring about this full-orbed expression of a homo cosmology. And really, the biblical message of a hetero cosmology has always been surprising. It was surprising when Moses spoke to the Canaanites and the Egyptians about it. It was brand new right then. It certainly was mind-bending when the Apostle Paul announced it to the Greco-Roman world, and it will probably get the same response from us. So I'm suggesting to you that we are in a struggle for knowledge, a struggle for truth, and that we need to see that there really are finally only two alternatives: a oneist view of existence or a twoist view of existence. A friend down here, I forget your name, reminded me that C.S. Lewis said that there are only two basic religions, Christianity and Hinduism, and all the others are simply deformations of those two. Lewis saw that very clearly. But I think it's become even more clear to me by seeing that this is rooted in what Paul is teaching about the undiscerning and the discerning mind. And I think as we continue to think about what's happening in our culture, it's very important to see the structural relationship between all these things that are going wrong in the culture, that they are deeply related. But I want to finish on a bright note, and that is to look at what a truest cosmology would look like. Because I do believe that as we seek to speak the truth to our world, we have an amazing message to bring that no other religion brings. It is a unique message. It always has been unique, as I indicated, and it's the same today. First of all, our understanding of who God is far superior to the pagan notions of God. Katy Perry, who sang at the Super Bowl, doesn't want anything to do now with the old man upstairs. I don't think she's ever been confronted with the God of the Bible. It's a shame. Her view of what Christianity is absolutely lacking in any kind of sense. And people need to hear that the God that we are proclaiming is totally other, and that his qualities of lordship, sovereignty, and transcendence are essential to who he is, if indeed he is other and unique. And I have to think that people who've been brainwashed with this God within surely will get tired of seeing this God every morning as they shave. You know, after a time, do you lose the desire to worship that kind of a God? Whereas we are faced as Christians with the impenetrable mystery of the great other. The kind of God I would want to worship would have to look something like that. A God that I could not, you know, just put in my pocket and dominate, but a God who goes way beyond anything we can imagine, who gives beginning to existence, to everything. And as indicated in the earlier talk, the mystery deepens because this God who is totally other is also personal. Obviously, the importance of the Trinity for this doctrine is essential, and especially as we begin to meet up with friends who may be Muslims. Is Islam truest? Is often the question that is raised to me. And I would say that it seems like it formally, because God is so separate from us, but actually, the more you realize what Islam is, the more you realize that it's a totally false truism, and it is always tending towards oneism. It's a false truism because God is a singularity. He's a monad. He's alone forever, at least before the creation. But God is a singularity and thus can never be personal. There's no relationship within God. And I think that's why you see the cruelty of ISIS in our time, because there is no personal value that seems to come down to these followers of such a God. Now, for God, the Muslim God, to become personal, it is sometimes said in the Quran that God swears by things in the creation. And it's probably true that in order for God to be personal, he had to create us. Thus, God becomes dependent for an essential attribute on the creation. And that makes him a oneist God. He's no longer transcendent. So only the biblical God of the Trinity is truly a satisfying notion of divinity that we can propose to the people we meet. I want you to get a hold of that, that our notion of God is far superior to any other teaching about the divine. And I think that should be part of our gospel witness. God is both transcendent and personal. The second thing that I think is valid about our witness and must appear, of course, is the high view of humanity that our biblical faith reveals to us. Each person is marked by the image of God, is unique and distinct from all others. And of course, that explains all the notions that we see in our liberal world about human rights and human dignity. We are made as God's agents in this world for His pleasure and for our own. We are made for each other to be present and relational with each other. This is a noble definition of who we are. As I indicated earlier, the image of God within us affirms then that we reflect in some poor and simple way this enormous mystery of the person of God. And we do so as well in our heterosexual distinctions, which Paul calls natural in Romans 1:26. And so we will probably, doubtless, and I know Reverend Wilson has been taking on this debate in colleges very bravely. I saw one video. I was in great admiration the way you did it. But more and more, this is going to be a difficult debate. But I do think we have to come back to the dignity of the human being made in God's image, male and female. And that we, as I think as my wife's talk yesterday shows, our world will implode on its failure to be able to identify finally who we are as gendered human beings. So I think we have a message here. It's going to be very difficult sometimes to make that point. I always say, and I said this 2 days ago, I was sitting next to Rosario Butterfield. We were both giving, some of you may have heard of Rosario Butterfield, she's a little lady, so I felt quite tall, actually. I said to this great crowd of people, you know, one of the useful ways of talking about homosexuality in today's world is not necessarily a kind of a moralism, God hates fags kind of a thing, but engaging that subject in a cosmology. How is the world put together? How are human beings put together? You know, in a sense, I came up with this silly little formula, egg plus sperm equals human civilization. You follow that? Egg plus sperm equals human civilization. There's no future of human civilization without those distinct things coming together to produce human civilization. And so really the dignity of the human being here and the human being's survival is dependent upon a biblical definition of the human being. I think we have a powerful message to take to the world if they listen to us, by the way. And they won't necessarily listen to us, but when they do, I do think we have a strong message of human dignity to bring. In terms of how we know meaningfully, truism makes sense of the world in which we find ourselves. Because the mind is a distinction-producing, sense-making factory. It's interesting that these gurus, these oneist gurus, tell us to flee the mind, to stop thinking. The most amazing thing we could ever do, which is to think, is not allowed in pagan spirituality. You have to stop thinking. I have to think that is a fundamental question of the authenticity of this movement, if it's telling us to deny the very power of the mind. But rationality, you see, we can't stop speaking, and when we speak, we have to be rational. Even the postmodernists, you know, they say that there is no such thing as truth. But they're obliged to at least make one true statement, that there is no such thing as truth. In other words, we are in a rational universe, and we know why. It's not that human beings make sense, but the universe is bathed in sense because God is the creator of it. So we can refer to God as the ultimate source of rationality. I think that makes sense of our world, like paganism doesn't, which is always driving us to irrationality. So I think we here are talking about a discerning mind when we can show that. We have a superior notion of revelation. I studied the Gnostic texts when I was a graduate student, and I was always surprised to find that there was really no such thing as scripture. There were all these books that individuals sort of produced sayings and so on, but the notion of scripture was absent. Anybody could write any one of these Gnostic texts, and they could be a success. But here in the biblical revelation, we have a word from the outside on which we can depend, on which we can build our understanding of everything. Because God is a God of verbal communication. Isn't it interesting that the Bible tells us, in the beginning was the Word? That's part of the rationality argument, I suppose, as well. But the world is based on Word, not on myth. It's based on sense. And the Bible brings us that ultimate revelation of what the world means. We can see it in the way God makes the world, and scientists are often amazed at how quite mind-blowing the structures of this world are. I'm not a scientist, but I realize that. But finally, God reveals himself through scripture. I think the biblical message as well of truism makes sense of morality. It's interesting that in a pagan worldview, you have to join the opposites, conjunctio oppositorum. All these things that are different, you have to bring them together and you transcend over them yourself. And that's true as well about right and wrong. So that a pagan worldview ultimately cannot eliminate from the world evil. It has to sort of justify it. Have you noticed how some of our journalists in today's world can't use the word evil? It somehow it goes against them because they want everything to be one. And as soon as you use the word evil, you've described something that goes outside of that. But unfortunately, that's the problem, you see, that oneism, as it claims, everything is one, that has to include evil. And we're stuck with evil. And some of these people have actually said that Hitler is in heaven because his deeds were not evil, they were mistakes. Say that to 6 million Jews. Sorry, it was a mistake. It doesn't make sense. We know evil. We see it in our own hearts. It's written on our hearts, and it's written on stone given to Moses. So we have the law from the inside and from the outside. And that law, that sense of what is good or evil, actually flows from God himself. I found a wonderful Roman Catholic philosopher that almost sounds like Van Til, if that's possible, Sokolowski, and he talks about cosmic goodness, which comes from the Creator. Because God is so independent of the world, we can say that he created the world out of sheer generosity, not out of any sort of need. In doing so, he has shown the charity that is at the heart of things. See, it's God's goodness that claims this world and puts the mark of goodness and identifies what is evil relative to that goodness. And so we can make sense of good and evil. And those people that deny it, really, if you stole their car, would be very happy to take you to the Supreme Court eventually and get you punished, because unfortunately, we all live in a moral universe. And you can deny it as much as you want to, but we have to function that way. And the Christian faith, you see, really allows that. We have the only satisfying account of redemption. Unfortunately, this one-ist system can only propose self-salvation. And I'm sure people must get tired of trying to figure out how they can save themselves. But the reconciliation that comes from God of creatures requires an unimaginable, divinely conceived solution that goes beyond anything human beings could devise. The gospel story has not been created by human beings. It is so amazing. I must hurry on. In terms of spirituality, you know, everyone's into spirituality today, and you can probably engage with all your friends for hours as they tell you how spiritual they are, how they, in meditation, have reached various stages of transpersonal experiences and so on. Sadly, I think all that finally leads to the occult, but that's for another day. But that mysticism really never gets beyond the ceiling, because it is inwardly focused on the self. It's an attempt to change one's own inner status and convince oneself that what one actually sees isn't true, and everything that is true is unimaginable or without form. So Eastern meditation focuses on inner divinity, tries to develop ecstatic trances, whereas spirituality in the Bible is quite different. Meditation, according to David, is conscious thinking about the person and works of God. He says, "I will ponder all your work and meditate on your mighty deeds," Psalm 77:12. And so there's a very real difference in spirituality understood as meditation. In the one, you're meditating on yourself. That's like shaving in the mirror again without looking in the mirror, to be focused on the self. I have a sense gets awfully old real quick. Whereas to meditate on God and his goodness does not get old. But there's another element to spirituality, and it's what we enjoyed earlier as we heard that choir sing. And Psalm 22:22 says of Jesus, "I will tell of your name to my brothers in the midst of the congregation. I will sing your praise." You know, I attended the Parliament of the World's Religions, not in 1893, by the way, in 1993. This was a 100-year celebration of this massive event. And I watched, 8,000 delegates from all the world's religions lock arms and dance around a ballroom in Chicago affirming their unity. I didn't do that, by the way. I was an observer. But I observed them trying to sing hymns, sort of. But it was just a washout. They couldn't do it. Because, you see, ultimately, the pagan worship of nature is a worship of the self. You're part of nature. So real praise is to praise the other, right? And we're made for praise. And you know that you cannot stand people who walk in a room and demand self-praise. But the experience of actually giving praise to the other is so liberating. And that's what we can do with our eyes fixed on the Lord. I got one more thing to say, and that is that this transformation of the mind, in terms of all these strong notions of a robust witness in our present day world, finally depends upon power. What do I mean by that? It's the power of the gospel. It's a powerful word that declares to us that God is on our side. If God is for us, says Paul, who can be against us? Romans 8:32. For he who did not spare his own son, but delivered him up for us all, how can he not with him give us all things? This is the all-powerful Creator who is at the heart of redemption in the giving of everything for us. But there's an interesting play on words here. In Romans chapter 1, in verses 24, 26, and 28, you remember Paul describes the various exchanging of the truth for the lie. And each time Paul says, and God gave them over. So in this world, sinners experience in whatever ways, I'm not sure exactly what that means, the results of their sinning doubtless, God gives them over to the results of their choices. Now that's not the final judgment, because one day they will be ultimately judged if they have not turned to Christ. But in life, in history, there is this experience of giving over. But I'm wondering if that is partly showing people the law to bring them to Christ, to show them their sin. But the interesting thing is that in Romans 8:32, that same verb, given over, is used. It's the verb in Greek, paradoken, to give over. Three times God gives them over, but now in 8:32, it says, and God gave over his son in the place of sinners. That's the good news, it seems to me, that brings power to our witness. If God is for us, who can be against us? He who spared not his own son, but gave him over, paradoken, for us all, how will he not also with him graciously give us all things? So that's our message. It's the unique message of a truest gospel that includes at its very center, you see, the power of the gospel itself. It is a worldview, but it's a worldview that can only be understood in terms of the gospel. That's why Paul, on his way to Rome, chained to a couple of soldiers, says, I am not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God unto salvation for everyone who believes, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. Dear friends, we're in a weird time in history. But it's almost starting to look like the weird time of the first century. And that exhortation that was good in the first century is thus good for us. The Lord wants from us holy bodies and transformed minds. Thank you.